campus. After the fellow had worked there for 3 or 4 year weeks, she had, was talking to the boy. He said, "You know," he says, "I think maybe that I might not go to the university this fall." And but he said, in order, this is on a Monday, and he says, in order to be fair to Dr. Bunnell, he said, so that he would know that I'm not going
this
to
is
be
Mr.
going
Kerner.
And so forth. He says, "I feel that I plan to leave this Friday, but I feel that I should go in and state my case and make it rather clear." And the boys who knew Dr. Bunnell suggested to him that he wait until Friday. But this was on a Tuesday in the morning, and he went in about 8 o'clock, and he presented his case to Dr. Bunnell, and within 5 minutes he had his bag and baggage, and he was going down the road. The other thing that was rather interesting, if you want to talk about Dr. Bunnell, was the fact that the first summer I worked upon the campus, like all construction jobs, there are times
Kerner.
When you're not too busy. So we were, this was a couple of days when things were kind of slack, and so in the area, which later got to be the laundry, it was a room that had been concreted in but hadn't been finished off. Why? There wasn't very much to do. Of course, I was concerned because I needed the money, and it was important that I work, and so forth. And so another student and myself, we went down there, and we were told to clean this. Now, as we looked at this job to be done down there, it was evident that this is something that could be done within an hour. And we completed the cleaning of it up, but we had about 3 or 4 days to kill, and so we didn't know what to do, but we felt that we should be there, and we wanted to be able to work and so forth. And the other kid went over and sat in the corner, and I said, "Well, what if Dr. Bunnell comes along?" I said, he would fire us, not doing anything. And he said, "Forget about it." He sat there for a while, and he said, "Oh," he said, "it's time to work." So he got to his feet, and we had our rakes, and we moved this, and there was Dr. Bunnell. And he stopped, walked through, and said, "Yeah, you're doing a fine job, you're getting it all done." And then he was gone, and this kid sat down. And so I said, "Well, how does he mystically know when Dr. Bunnell is doing, because he's not worried about it?" So I sat down beside him, and it wasn't long until I heard this. There comes Dr. Bunnell. He moved this pile a little bit more. Well, it's kind of cute, you know, because sometime later after I worked there this summer, Dr. Bunnell says, "You know," he says, "I've never caught anybody loafing." He said, "As long as I've ever been in charge of a job, I've never caught anybody loafing." But if you know Dr. Bunnell, you know, wherever he went this.
He'd be the little forewarning there. And it saved many of us many a time.
I guess it was a little bit hard for Dr. Bunnell to give up his running the university. I was teaching there from 50 to 52, and Terrace Moore was president, and the administration, it didn't come very easy to Terrace Moore, as some of you know. But Dr. Bunnell's office was right across the hall from Terrace Moore, which didn't make it easy, because Dr. Bunnell was still trying to exert his influence running the university. I didn't know Bunnell when he was in good form. Of course, he was a lot better in 50 to 52 than he had been
right.
Two or three years before, and he was going tolerably good then. I got pretty well acquainted with him and liked the man pretty well, but I could see he hated to give up power.
Well, he was glad to get rid of it in 49 because he was very ill. But you see, then shortly after that, he began to regain his health. And so for a few years, he made a comeback, and he was really in better health than... Well, he was diabetic, and it wasn't discovered until he was actually in shock before they decided that they better do something, or he'd never go to a doctor, you know. Year in and year out, never go to a doctor. Fight it through somehow.
You know, something back in the day, when
George Dickey
building the Alston Memorial Building that summer, prior to building it, all the concrete, I forget the name of the people now, that's a long time ago, but an architect from Juno designed...
Lester Trost.
Yeah, designed the Alston Memorial Building, so the material started coming in, so... shipped in concrete, cement, sacks of cement in boxcars. So it happened at this time I was working there, and I had a crew, and I can't remember who all, but five or six people. I remember Gwen Franklin was there, and George Cabell and Cochler, two people that I just had to remember. But at any rate, we had that little old blue Chevy truck, 3-ton or something. So he said, okay, you unload the boxcars. And we went down to unload the boxcars, and he said, now, the last time we unloaded cement on this job, we unloaded a boxcar in 5 hours. Oh, okay, this is fine. And so we went down, and we started unloading these things, and we had unloaded this car. Car holds, I think, 60 tons or something. We unloaded the damn thing and had it up there in 2.5 hours. And we unloaded. And I went up. The judge happened to be down at his house. And I said, we're up. I said, we're unloaded. The guy looked at me, you know, kind of in shock, and he was actually PO'd at me. Jesus, you know, like, can't you take a joke? I was just kind of exaggerating. It didn't have to work. He says, I guess you guys have done enough work. We better come in and have a beer. So right in the basement, he had beer down there. And you're not supposed to drink on the campus, but at any rate, he gave us all beer. And he says, you guys better knock off for the day. You've done a day's work.
Day's work.
I was on that detail.
Huh?
I was on that detail.
Were you on that detail?
Yes, sir. I came out green.
Yeah, you put it on your bag.
That was a hard day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Did you get the bottle of beer?
Yes.
Okay.
You were there.
Yeah.
Speaking of the judge and his bottle, reminds me of a story that I heard from somebody about a couple of years after I left there. But they said that one night Sacred Semple ordered a bottle from town, and the taxi was supposed to bring it out to the campus to Hess Hall. And she didn't tell him where Hess Hall was. I guess she figured all the cab drivers knew. So the guy gets out there, the first lights on the campus he comes to is the judge's house. So he takes a bottle in his hand and he walks to the door and he says, I've got something here to deliver to a Sigrid Sepoli. Can you tell me where I'll find her? And the judge says, well, I'll be seeing her in a little while. I'll take it up. Half an hour later, he goes into his hall and they call Sigrid down and says, this was left for you. And he gives it to her.
No, this guy was great. You know?
Yeah. Well, someone said the other day, you know, even someone that, you know, had reason to disagree with him at times, that Bunnell was always thinking, you know, about a week ahead of everybody else. He'd anticipate almost everybody what they were going to think about. He'd think about it about a week ahead of them, you know, and so he was always a little bit ahead of the game. So it might be true.
Well, you know, Al and somebody lived in the main building in a room. And we worked for George Keyes, and George Keyes was Johnny Booth and Bob Harrop was involved in this, and I don't know who all was involved, but anyhow, Al had a room right over by the tunnel in the floor area here, and Christmas came along, and they had, I don't know, some wine or cordial, I don't make any difference what it was, but they had a few bottles, and the guys come in for Christmas like they did, and they have a drink. George Keyes was very anti-booze, and he had kind of sponsored Al, and I worked in the power plant, so I was sponsored, so I had no problem. At any rate, something happened to the electrical system. Electrical system run through this room, out of the tunnel, and back of the Davenport and up, and George Keyes got over there, and they pulled the Davenport up, and Christ, there was half a dozen bottles. I don't know what Al's capacity was at the time, but he was something. George Keyes went up to the president and reported him for having the booze in the room. And so Al come around to me and said, Jesus, we're in the hot seat, what do we do? who talked to Prexy. So he went up to Prexy and explained his situation. He says, well, says, you know how it is. Says, some people like beer, some people like wine, and some people like water. And says, not all we can do about it.
Yeah. Hi, we have some late comers.
Marion Hall.
Boy, I don't want to record the story of your trials in getting here, but
you don't.
No, you want to brush them up a little bit? Oh, do tell us about it.
She loves us here, we know.
You know Virginia, don't you?
No,
I'm not. Virginia, come up there.
No, I met Marion last night. You weren't at the meeting last night.
Bill?
Yeah.
Bill?
Yeah, I'm
just.
Did you ever ride the elevator or the federal building?
I'm Virginia Fred Rothaker.
Virginia Rothaker on the elevator in the federal building, and every time we had a dance, she was out there with Billy Roach, standing out there, and all the boys drooled.
Isn't that something?
That, tell us about
good
it.
Good to see you. Say, we're a little bit.
Now you remember.
Now I remember.
Yeah. The face is familiar.
Well, it's certainly a nice heckling, Marion. And Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
I told Francis that I've been trying for 10 years to get to a Southern California meeting. Ever since I was first secretary for Northern California, Gordon and I used to exchange rosters. And we thought what a fine group you had here. I
want to
come down and get acquainted.
Oh, we've had a big time tonight.
And then you had a little trouble getting here. You had to be
distracted. Oh, I've been out with a policeman tonight.
Yeah,
I
do.
She missed him. Yeah. I saw him at the tail end of him. He missed darling.
Oh, my God.
So we came for dinner. We're going to stay tonight.
I don't know. We're going to have a little trouble finding food. I think we ate it all around
oh,
here.
No, we just had the most sumptuous banquet. Oh, more than we could eat. We hardly dented what you got guys left.
You know, I told a story about your wanting me to take a quick run around the deck a little bit, you know, to work up an appetite. Well, last night I told the story. I didn't have the buttons punched and I didn't have it on the record. So tonight I told it over again. I hope it's on the record.
I thought about it tonight thinking when we walked in, if Cashin pulls that on me, tonight I'm going to eat him again.
Run around the block a few times, Mary, and work up an appetite.
Yes,
you know?
Indeed. I've been running around the freeway.
Well, I think clearly that Mary had a story concerning Dr. Cannell.
Well, I think perhaps the funniest was the day we arrived at college. My brother and I left Chicago with, we drove a car out to Seattle for a dealer. And we had a few $20 money orders in our pockets. We'd sold our canoe and living room drapes to have money to make this trip, and we were poor. And when we got to Juneau, we worked during the summer. My brother was a printer, and he worked for the paper there, and I ran a boarding house for college students who'd come up to work in the mines all summer. And we met a woman whose husband was Marshall up in Fairbanks area, and she said she wouldn't hesitate to go to the college without a dime to her name because they needed students. So my brother and I said, well, this is fine. We need an education, and this would be a good chance to spend a winter up where the dog sleds are. So he sent me up on the Northwestern. That's the night
steerage in the same trip.
He had to work 2 weeks to finish paying the bills so he could join me. And I spent a week in Anchorage with a friend I had made, and she sent me on my way. And we arrived in Fairbanks. He came up from the highway, and I came up on the railroad, so I think he got there the night before I did. There's a big jog in the time. And we walked out to the college with Bill Green. Remember him?
Well, there was a Bill Green student and a Bill Green professor, agriculture. Yeah.
And he was had come up on the truck with my brother, and we all walked out to meet Dr. Bunnell and to see if we could be taken in at school. Yeah. So when we talked to his secretary, now what was her name? A little Irish girl. At any rate, she gave us a story, something to fill out, and she took it into him and brought it out. She said, but you didn't fill out how much money you have. You know, you put down how much is in the bank account and how much the people at home are going to send you and so forth. And I had $9 and Bob had $11. This was our total bill.
Yeah.
We were orphans. I had a brother working back in Chicago, but he wanted to get married. He didn't want to send us any money. So we put that down and she took it back into him. And we could just see his hands go later. We knew this was his expression, and he sent her back out. Bring him in here. He said, what do you mean coming up here with that kind of money? And we said, well, we heard you needed students. We like to work and we want to come to school here. Well, what can you do? So he called the news minor and got Bob a job right away. And he had some of those $30 a month library jobs he gave me. I couldn't type worth a darn. Poor Mrs. Ryan.
Yeah.
She had to put all my, I did those acquisition cards, and every week she had to throw half of them back to me to be repeated.
Yeah. But you stayed on, anyway.
Well, Bob lasted a year, and then he had a girl back home, and I stayed 4 years. But I didn't, I only stayed in school another year.
Yeah.
And it took me another year
of ham, earning
enough money to go home on.
You know. Well told. Well, of course, there were a lot. I don't, that might have been the minimum arrival fund there. $20 for two. That's not very much.
Well, I think we did very well. Bob helped me because he made more money working for the newspaper. Once they found out he could run a linotype and do everything in the plant, he worked a full 8 hours a day.
That's right, I remember.
And when my money ran out, the debts got to where even Bunnell couldn't write me a check to cover him. You know, bless his heart, I needed registration money and chemistry fees, and I went in and told him, I just said, I need $18.50, and he didn't say a word. He just reached for his checkbook and wrote me a check. They told me that was pretty unusual. We did pay him back as we earned money, but he also, you have to pay your room and board in advance when you live in the dormitory.
Yeah.
And he just wrote me a check to pay for it without any questions.
Oh, yeah.
No note or
anything. You weren't the only one. He'd go through several stacks of checkbooks every registration. But he wanted that money in advance for the kitchen. He had to keep the account straight.
I like to be a little bit trite. You might shut off your machine.
Oh, I don't know, Bob. Shall I?
I have a very good friend who is influential down at SC, and apparently Carl Franklin is screwing up SC as bad as he screwed up the University of Alaska.
Now you're getting pretty personal there. But this was one of the nice things about it. Of all the thousands of dollars that he'd lent, you know, on these little loans to help people over there, I think he was paid back every cent, and he was very proud of that. But the last holdout was Brooks Drayton. Do you remember? And there's
right out here in Claremont.
By golly, you know, there's correspondence in the file with Brooks Drayton way up until 1950, I think. Finally, Brooks paid him, you know, and
well,
he was...
that's why he dropped out of our alumni association. He was here.
He had to back. I think he was the last holdout, but the correspondence between Bunnell and Brooks Drayton fills quite a folder, you know. Back and forth, you know.
I wonder how many notes he signed. I think he must have signed 5 or 6.
Oh, yeah. There was hardly a student that didn't go through without some kind of help over there.
Every semester.
Or whatever.
Except maybe
Saxon,
the Indian from Arkansas, you know, he got, I'm not supposed to say this because I work in the bank, you know, for 2 years.
remember.
No, I remember Harry.
Well, yeah. He attended one of our meetings.
Harry?
In Los Angeles. Yes, he was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
He lives in, he did live in, I think he's on our list in Calhoun. I talked to him once when we had a meeting there a few years ago, and I could make a free phone call to him.
Well, the scarcity of money and students reminds me of my first encounter with Dr. Bunnell.
This is Gordon Peacock.
I remember during the summer of 1932 in Fairbanks, jobs were mighty scarce, as well as students for the college. So someone told me that if you want a job, go to the college and tell Dr. Bunnell that you're interested in going to school, because he had placed many students with the Alaska Railroad. Dr. Bunnell seemed rather pleased with my noble interest of going to school and didn't seem to be at all surprised when I told him I was broke and needed a job. So he pondered it for a few seconds and said, I think this can be arranged. Then he asked me, what high school did I graduate from? Well, you can imagine his surprise when I replied that I had never gone to high school. Well, it has a little happier ending. That was not the end of my association with Dr. Bunnell. I remember he looked at me very quizzically and must have thought, boy, what next? So he recommended that I go down and see Hampton Blaine and tell him, I sent you. Now, I found out later that Hampton Blaine owed Dr. Bunnell a great deal of money, and I sent you with the command, give this fellow a job. So Hampton Blaine seemed very pleased, gave me a job weeding and harvesting his truck garden. And boy, I took pride in my work because some of the other farmers on the loop, like Willie Yankovich, the Huffman brothers, Paul Johnson, sought my services. Well, oftentimes Dr. Bunnell would walk to Blaine's ranch, about a mile away, to visit with us. And I guess in a very coy way, gave me a little pep talk about going to school. And I remember once he said, here's a few boxes of old 22 bullets. I have no need for them. Could you use them? Well, the rabbit cycle was starting in 1932 and flourished in 38 and 40. So I wondered, though, after the harvest was in, that Hampton Blaine changed his mind about my becoming a partner at his gold load mine at the head of Ready Bullion on Esther Dome. The plans were that I was going to work at the mine on a partnership basis. And I suspect Dr. Bunnell had something to do with it. Well, it didn't take long that winter started, and I started to walk to the college, was about a mile away. Then got on Paul Grimen's bus, rode into Fairbanks 4 miles, and then walked from the garage to the high school that was at 7th and Cushman, I believe, about a third of a mile, and returned to the ranch at night. Well, this routine continued for 3 years during the winter time until Hampton passed away in the spring of 35. And that fall, I enrolled at the university as a special student. Frank Yerg also enrolled as a special that year. Well, while completing my enrollment with Dean Patty, I was interested in mining. Who should I see in Dean Patty's office but a fellow I hadn't seen since I was about 5 years old. We used to play shinny hockey between the streetcar tracks. It was packed very hard and icy, and that was Arne Hainer. Hadn't seen him since I was 5 years old till the fall of 35 in Dean Patty's office. Then I was rather surprised when Dean Patty told me after our consultation, Dr. Bunnell wants to see you in his office. So I went up and saw Dr. Bunnell, and if I recall rightly, he congratulated me for perseverance. Now, as I look back over those years, I'm very grateful to three men that made it possible for my going to school. Hampton Blaine for providing a ranch home. We had saddle horses and everything. Wonderful life. Cap Osborne and later Jack Boswell of the FE Company for giving me a job and permitting me to live on campus. And I think especially a very humane Dr. Bunnell for encouragement. That year of 1935 was a very exciting year. We had a very exciting freshman class. Carol was in it.
I was in it.
And yes,
I
and we.
Was
in fact, I have a.
I
have a picture of you. I was looking at tonight. You played the lady known as Lou. Our
yes,
class put on the play, the shooting of Dan McGrew.
Hello, brother.
Where's that at that?
Yeah.
In a
table. Remember the bartender?
Yeah, and I was the bartender.
Yeah,
well, anyway, we certainly had some characters in that freshman class. I remember one fellow in particular who took great pride in saying he was the valedictorian of his class. Well, it was rather shocking to us. After the first 6 weeks test, we found out that he not only missed all of the questions, but got a minus 2 grade for misspelling words. Later we found out that there was only one in his graduating class. I won't reveal the name because probably he's still living. You know,
getting back to this story of the shooting of Dan McGrew in the Eagle in the Eagles Hall this night that you put on that show. I happened to be the, I don't know what you call it, the stage manager or what, but what was the guy's name that owned the theater in town?
Lathrop.
No, not Lathrop.
Don Adler was the manager.
Adler. Okay, Don Adler. And Don Adler owned the Chena Bar.
Yeah.
Had some affiliation. So we're putting on this show. These are college students. I know Dwayne Hall was a Dan McGrew and you were in it, all this thing. And so I said, look, these guys are putting on this show and you're making money. At least with these drinks you put on, they should have some beer there. And he said, okay. So he called up. I remember that big, broad-shouldered bartender at the Chena Bar. So I got a couple guys to go
Frank
with me.
Wright.
Is that, you know? Yeah.
He turned me off once.
So we worked at the Chena Bar. Don Adler called and said, "Give these guys beer." So I went over and he says, "How much you want?" And I said, "Well, how much can we carry?" And we loaded up all this bar beer and took it over and we're putting on the show. Now, we had a guy by the name of Dewey Smith. Remember Dewey?
Yes.
Okay. Dewey was, I'd say, the number one sponger of the university. So we're putting on the show, and here's the crowd out here, the auditorium, and everything's going big, and this show's going on. And Dewey, some way, he wasn't connected with the show, but he found out that there was beer. And so he come around, and he was out in the back. And the show's going on, and it was very dramatic, and everything's going. And Dewey walked out on the stage, and he says, "Where the hell's the beer opener?"
Ruined the act.
Carl Kaiser visited with Dewey Smith last winter in Florida.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the name of the kid that played the piano? He's the only man I ever knew that charged a car in the red light district.
Earl Fossey.
His name was Rob something.
He was related to the guy that was Charlie Fowler's assistant.
He was from Louisiana, and he was one of these remittance men. You know, they paid him as long as he stayed away from home. And every month his folks sent money to the judge, and the judge doled it out to him.
Can you run down to
now? No, I can't.
What?
Bob Starkey.
Charlie Starkey.
No,
Bob Starkey.
Was that it, Starkey?
Cashin could play the piano.
Yeah.
That was really pretty good. He had a different style than Cashin.
He played that.
You know, he just sit down there and sort of roll his hands
on. I have visioned about the University of Alaska.
Maybe he didn't need a charge card.
there. You know, there's always been the...
I don't remember.
Playing piano.
Numbers for music. He just sit down and sort of...
I sure was a bandless place in 1935, obviously.
Yeah, hopping, wasn't it?
Have Virginia tell us how many miles she had on the post office elevator. Do you remember? Vertical.
Well, you know, when summer of 37, when the Russians were flying over the North Pole, I worked for the Weather Bureau that summer. So I ride up to the top floor of the Weather Bureau in Virginia. And they had pulled a trick on me in the Weather Bureau of letting me breathe the hydrogen, and then you talk, and your vocal cords are in this rarefied air. You squeak way up there, and it's fun. So we did this to the two Russians that were there that summer, and then we take the hydrogen. We get Virginia off the elevator, and let her have the hydrogen. And she just kept gulping it, and she was so sick we thought she was going to die. That was a real fun time. Remember when the plane...
I remember when that was. I got a picture of the Russians and their plane. Yeah,
well,
they brought back a little polar bear cub. I have movies of that.
Yeah, the pilot brought back three cubs, if you remember.
No, we had just the one.
What was his name? The fellow that had the... he did a lot of ferrying of supplies up there. When there were four Russians in town, one newspaper man whose name was Leo Plott, and first time he was introduced to someone, and I didn't get your name, Plott. What? No, your name. I didn't get your name. It's Plott. And then the two engineers stayed all winter, if you remember, while they were doing all that searching over the pole. Theoretically, to find their plane that was down, but in 37 it was very obvious later on that they were simply doing polar area research for war purposes.
Did you see in the paper just recently that General St. Clair Spreese just died recently, and he was the leader of the first Army airplane group that ever came up to Fairbanks? They flew from New York to Nome and back.
I got the National Geographic that has that in, I collect those geographic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I believe he was a major.
He was a captain.
He was a captain.
Yeah.
He tells of all their troubles, how they were down and it'd take them weeks to get going somewhere. And he ends this is 1924, I believe, in the 24 issue. And he ends this article by how hard it was, but what an experience it was. And then he says, and who knows? They may make this trip overnight sometime. That's just the way the article ends.
Well, we certainly have some interesting stories about Dr. Bunnell. Anybody else have stories of Dr. Bunnell? Or
the thing that I recall so much was the fact that his office was right there off the main hall, and I'm sure other people had the same feeling I did, that you were always a favorite child when you went in and talked to him for a few minutes, whether it was because you had a problem or whether you just stopped in to say hello to him. And he seemed to welcome you and treat you like one of his own kids and not just some student, and he was the president of the university. That I think perhaps that's the tone of the school, that it was as small and as cozy as it was.
During the period I was going with his daughter, I never got that same impression.
Or there could have been a reason.
There was.
Yeah. Well, let's say he was perhaps judging others by himself.
It could be.
Either that or might have forgot to turn off the lights on night before he left.
Right.
You know, that must have been quite some time ago, because Dorothy and Warren had their 40th wedding anniversary.
Recently?
Yes. How recent was
last
it?
Last April.
As days we can figure, Dorothy was 3 years old when he got married.
Yeah, I think it was around that.
A child bride.
How many of you remember Eunice Collins?
Yeah.
thinking?
Oh, yes.
He sent a refusal card for our dinner last night.
Oh, she did?
And she lives in Soquel.
Where?
Soquel, out of Santa Cruz.
Do you have her address?
Yes, I do.
Oh, with you?
I brought all my papers, and I've got about 6 changes of addresses for you, too.
Yes, well, I received a letter about 6 months ago from Barney Berry. He's very anxious to locate Pinky Collins, and he asked me if I knew of anybody else that...
Well, before the evening's over, I'll be here.
All right, and I'll send it to Barney, or do you have Barney's address?
Offhand, I don't know. I'll have to go look and see.
Well, I can give you this letter, which has his address, and if you send it to him, do you remember Barney Berry?
Yeah, I do.
All right.
But you've got a couple of our good members. They just meet down here somewhere. I don't know. I have to go look at it. I didn't take reservations for the dinner.
No.
For last
John
night.
John Boswell. That was Jack Boswell's son.
Yes. They just handed me the cards, and there were changes of addresses of people who moved into Noble Dick Jr.'s in Canoga Park. Remember that one?
Oh.
Did you know him at all?
No.
Well, Dr. Dick was the eye doctor down, and Noble Dick Jr. went to the university, and he's been living in Santa Rosa, and he's moved to Canoga Park, and would be very much interested in your group, said some of us had a change of address.
Very good, and you got those addresses.
Yeah, but I thought many of you that knew Eunice would be interested to know that she came to a dinner 3 or 4 years ago, and... wrote on her card that a physical problem prevented her from joining us last night, otherwise she would have been there. Bill Burns came to our dinner last night.
Bill Burns?
You would remember Bill.
Yeah.
I met him.
The oldest Burns boy.
Frank died.
No, the other way around. Bob died.
Oh, Bob.
Bob was the youngest.
Yeah, Bob
Burns. Bob was in the diplomatic
corps. I'm thinking of the young Anderson boy.
Jimmy
died. But it's Bob that died about 3 years ago, and Frank is in he's somewhere. Bill told me that Frank was improving and had been for several years, so I don't know whether he's in a sanitarium or what. I hadn't heard of him ill, but that's what Bill mentioned. And in the stress of conversation last night, I didn't get around to pinning him down to say, well, where is Frank? He's up in Florida somewhere. I don't know.
Bill is what has been, when we visited with him at Mountain View, right by Palo Alto, he was with the Kaiser Permanente company,
right.
And he's still with them. He lives in that
in
area.
Soquel,
why didn't Louis Smith come to your meeting?
He had a previous commitment. He hasn't missed a dinner. He was at the picnic last spring, he and Shirley.
Is that the end of the meeting?
I asked if there was any more stories concerning Dr. Bunnell.
12:15, I think we did pretty well here.
Are you satisfied with the account?
Yeah.
Well, we're just getting warmed up to some of the choices.
That's what I'm afraid of.
You make us self-conscious with that gadget.
Yeah, I know.
So we have to be discreet on what we tell.
Oh, poking it in your face.
Well, anyway, are there any more stories concerning Dr. Bunnell or anything anybody would want to say before we go into the door prize? I think in all fairness to everyone here, we should raffle these. I have all the numbers in this jar. And
what do you want, 50 cents a pick shot?
Every name tag you have has a number on it, beginning with 1.
Where's mine? Are we too late?
Well, I'll have to have a consultation with the committee.
It's the committee, so don't worry about it.
It'll cost you.
I can't read his number. What world is it?
Wally, will you...
Just 28.
See, when you paid, you got your ticket.
Oh. These will become collector's items, and for your and Virginia's benefit.
benefit. Wally, would you mention the ceramic?
These were made by Sasha Brostow. Sasha Brostow, who is about the leading ceramics maker in Los Angeles area. We acquired them through a bit of subterfuge of my wife's. They were made for the centennial. And as I told the group, my wife convinced him that he wouldn't need them for another 97 years. So we got them at a very nominal price, and I have given them to the group. The money used to go into the scholarship fund.
Well,